Welcome to Season 2 of Keeping Up with the Constitution, a podcast hosted by the University of Malaya Constiteam, bringing you a simple dissection of the Malaysian Constitution. My name is Davidson, and I'm thrilled to host the fourth episode of the podcast titled The Death Penalty in Malaysia, The Ongoing Debate. For today, I have with me Dato' Emeritus Professor Dr. Syed Salim Farooqi, Professor of Law at the University of Malaya, currently holding the Tunku Abdul Rahman Chair as Professor of Constitutional Law. Thank you so much, Prof. Syed, for joining us today.
Thank you, Davidson. Thank you for having me. I wish to also congratulate you, Charmaine, and Jason for organizing this. This reflects that you guys and gals have a extracurricular interest in promoting constitutional literacy, which is very, very commendable because the Constitution is our basic law. And you have a social conscience and a social perspective, and that you are trying to home in on some issues of great moral, political, and legal significance. Thank you very much for having me.
So before we start, I would just like to say, Prof. Syed, it's really a pleasure and honor for having you as our guest. And I'm very sure everyone is excited to hear what you have to say. So the death penalty is currently retained for 33 offences in Malaysia, including 12 for which it is the mandatory punishment. And in recent years has been used mostly for murder and drug trafficking. In this episode, we will be discussing the effectiveness of the death penalty in Malaysia and analyse arguments for both for and against the death penalty. So to start off, Prof. Syed, how did this death penalty come about under the Penal Code?
Well, I do not know about distant history. Let me just say this, that in almost all civilizations, cultures, legal systems in the past, death penalty in some form has always existed. It depends on how far back you want to go. In Malaya, however, we can say for recent history, the British adopted the Indian Penal Code and made murder a mandatory death penalty offense. Davidson, I'll have to point out to you that our discussion needs to distinguish between mandatory death and death penalty. As you already noted, some offenses are death penalty, others are mandatory death. The objections, the constitutional objections to mandatory death are very strong, but they are not necessarily so strong against death penalty per se. Anyway, the British had initiated this in Malaya, later Malaysia. We expanded the application of the death penalty much, much farther. Death penalty exists for a large number of offenses, as you mentioned. The numbers are a little bit different, Davidson. Some people say 14, some say 33. I think the reason for that is some people count the number of sections, but some people count within the same section there's more than one offense. But the important thing is that death penalty exists for a large number of offenses, personal offenses, political offenses. At the same time, there are some offenses which are mandatory death, and you have correctly observed the most important are murder and drugs, also firearms offenses. Now, between 1980 to 1986, we were hanging approximately 15 to 16 people per year. In 1992, I think these hangings peaked. We had 39 executions. So almost 3+ executions every month. But I think in the mid-1990s, some reservations began to grow that the death penalty is not really achieving its purpose, especially because most of the people being convicted were drug offenders or drug traffickers. In 2010, Suhakam, our Human Rights Commission, supported total abolition of the death penalty. In 2017, Section 39B of the Dangerous Drugs Act was amended to give the courts discretion to impose the death penalty or imprisonment, but it was not a full amendment to the law. The 39B was amended to say that the courts will have the discretion if the public prosecutor gives evidence that the accused had cooperated with the public prosecutor in investigating the crime. So basically, it's not the judge who had the final discretion. It was the Pandavaraya, the public prosecutor. So 2017 was a step forward towards removing the mandatory aspect of the death penalty, but it was a half-hearted attempt and was subject to a lot of criticism. So now what has happened is this, David, that though the law remains in place pretty much, the death penalty remains in place, mandatory remains in place, but there is a moratorium. For the last few years, nobody has been hanged. And the government has openly admitted that the government is relying on public opinion. The public must express opinion first, and then the government will act. So basically, the government's attitude is that we will react, not act. We will react to public opinion. That's where your role and my role and the role of non-governmental organizations come in. We have to mobilize public opinion. And at the moment, there are lots of pros and cons of the death penalty, but I think we'll look into that in one of your other questions later on in the podcast.
All right. So as we know, there are four main principles of these sentencings, right? So which is retribution, deterrence, rehabilitation, and prevention. So since you mentioned that this sentencing has been practiced since the colonization of the British in India and in Malaysia, then throughout a few decades ago, since the 80s, the 90s, and even in the early 2000s. So does this sentencing achieve any of this principle?
Well, when it comes to retribution, revenge, an eye for an eye, obviously death penalty achieves that purpose. The person who has committed a capital offense is sentenced to death. In some cases, he's hanged. In others, he languishes in prison. Nevertheless, retribution obviously is taking place. Prevention is also taking place, because once you hang him or you imprison him, he cannot commit the same offense. But when it comes to deterring others, David, deterring others, there is no clear evidence that anybody is deterred by the death penalty offense. There is no evidence. But I have to alert you all. This whole argument that does it deter or does it not deter is a little bit difficult to evaluate critically. Because if someone is deterred, it doesn't register. It is when someone commits the offense that the offense is registered. So how many people were actually deterred? Only God knows. All that we can look at is the data indicates that drug offenses, murders, continue to rise. Now, the conclusion, therefore, of many people is that, oh, the death penalty doesn't deter. And maybe that is correct. But I just want to alert you, because you're all scholars, I want to alert you that while there is very relevant suspicion that it does not deter, the problem of science or empirics is that it measures the measurable. It cannot measure the immeasurable. So if those who were deterred did not commit an offense, that cannot be measured. Also bear in mind, David, population is increasing. In the 70s, the Malaysian population was about 12 million. Now we are 32 million. So obviously, with the rise of the population, crimes abound to increase. And don't forget, another factor that contributes is poverty or the increase in the number of slums. There is a massive phenomena of migration of people from the rural areas to the urban ghettos. And I think that too contributes to crime. There's a massive problem, social problem, of people cutting off their roots in the villages and all the value systems moving to the towns into a new area. So I think these are some of the issues also that are relevant. But personally, I'm prepared to accept this view that deterrence is not working. But when it comes to deterrence, David, what is happening is we are using one human being as a guinea pig, as an instrument. We are instrumentalizing him or her to prevent others. And to me, that is immoral. We should not use one human being to deter others, because this means human beings are being instrumentalized. So while I'm prepared to accept retribution and prevention as justifiable, morally justifiable objects of the criminal process, I have problems about accepting deterrence of others. So I should be punished that you should be deterred. Now that's not moral, because I'm not just an instrument. When it comes to rehabilitation, obviously rehabilitation is irrelevant in relation to someone who is already hanged. So in answer to your question, retribution and prevention work, but deterrence and rehabilitation are obviously not relevant. So the other factor is this, David, that many offenses like murder are crimes of passion. They're not crimes which people commit after lots of planning. There are some murders which are premeditated, carefully planned and executed, but there are others in the heat of the moment. Boyfriend, girlfriend, husband and wife, brother and sister, parents and children. These are crimes of passion, and they will not be prevented because people are not doing these in after forethought. These are actually crimes of passion. So I think that this idea of deterrence is certainly not working, and this should not be put forward as a justification for hanging people or killing people. Thank you.
All right. What I have to say is an insight on what you give on the deterrence and prevention part. But here comes the golden question. One of the main and most common arguments against the death penalty in our society and the country we live in is that, is this sentencing a violation of human rights? Prof. Shah, may I ask your thoughts on this matter?
Yeah, sure. Obviously, David, there are clear implications for human rights. Let me just put it to you this way. If it is wrong for an ordinary citizen to kill another human being, then equally it is wrong for the government to extinguish a life which was given to a human being by God. So a wrong is a wrong. And in some respects, capital penalty is legalized murder. Legalized, yes, but it is murder nevertheless, because it amounts to the extinguishment of life. Nevertheless, there are lots of pros and cons, David, and I have to confess to you that there are no open and shut arguments in favor of one side or of the other. So let me sum up for you very briefly, hopefully very briefly. Teachers have difficulty keeping to time limits. Lawyers are also like that. I'm just joking. A lawyer will go to a court and submit a brief, and the brief is 80 pages. So lawyers are like that. Well, the arguments in terms of supporting the death penalty is this, that even in international law, David, Article 6, Clause 2, of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights 1966 does not forbid the death penalty completely. It simply says that death penalty shall be imposed only for the most serious crimes. So death penalty law is not necessarily a violation of international law, Article 6, Clause 2. But of course, an argument could be raised by some of you that for the many, many offenses for which we are imposing the death penalty, there is a violation of international law, because some of these offenses are not the most heinous or the most serious offenses. Later on, I'll point out to you some of the offenses, some of the capital offenses are basically political offenses. Okay, so that's one argument, that international law, even international law, does not really forbid. I know in international law, the inherent right to life is recognized, and the death penalty may be imposed only for the most serious crimes. And international law says there must be a right of appeal, and international law says there must be a right of pardon, and international law says that it must not be imposed on pregnant women and those below 18. And on that, David, our legal system accepts all these limitations. So we are not really violating international law, except possibly on this point, that our range, very broad range of death penalty offenses may be exceeding the intentions of international law. Okay, the second argument in favor of the death penalty retention is this, that international practice is such that Malaysia is not alone in having the death penalty. 71 or so countries of the world, including the USA, China, Iran, Saudi, Singapore, retain and use the death penalty. 71, 70 plus Malaysia, 71. Then third argument in favor is the moral or the religious argument. It is just retribution. There are some offenses which are so heinous, so large scale, so brutal, so inhuman, that the conscience of the community calls for a tough, uncompromising response. Sadly, it is a fact that within our society, there are some moral monsters who are unable to control their savagery and violence. So how should society deal with them? The argument is that it is better for society's welfare that they be made to pay the ultimate price for further evil acts. I'm thinking of offenses like genocide, terrorism. I'm thinking of offenses like rapists who will rape small children and murder them. I'm thinking of such heinous offenses. And the conscience of the community needs to be appeased on this point, some people say. Not necessarily my view, but this is the view of some people, that if there are moral monsters, then you've got to eliminate them. The next point that I want to make is this, that David, reverence for life, though very important, both in religion, in morality, ethics, and in law, reverence for life is not an absolute principle. No legal system exhibits an unconditional and absolute reverence for life. For example, everywhere there are laws on private defense. The people can kill others to defend themselves or their property, David, even their property. To safeguard their property, they can take the life of another. Then, in many countries of the world today, euthanasia is being allowed. Mercy killing is being allowed. So now, mercy killing basically amounts to extinguishing a life. In most countries, abortion is allowed. Abortion is allowed by Section 312 of our Penal Code. Initially, causing miscarriage was an offense, but later on they amended the law to say that a medical practitioner registered under the Medical Act, who is reasonably of the opinion that termination of the pregnancy is necessary for the physical or mental health of the mother, they can terminate the pregnancy. So abortion is allowed. police powers everywhere in the world. Police have some powers to extinguish a life in certain circumstances. And listen to this next one. The Charter of the UN permits wars of self-defense. I'm sure you will agree with me. All wars are mass murders. So international law allows mass murders, even in religion. Though killing is generally frowned upon, in some circumstances, the extinguishing of life is allowed. So these are, I think, four or five arguments in favor. But against the death penalty, there is a large number of arguments. I'll just quickly, I have 10 arguments here. Let me very quickly sum them up for you. Please stop me if I speak for too long. Number one is this. The trend around the world is now that the death penalty is either being abolished or it is not being used. So the worldwide trend is to move away from the death penalty. The second optional protocol of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights has been ratified by 57 nations, and it committed itself to total abolition. European and American conventions have moved in that direction. The UN Commission on Human Rights, by resolution 204/67, has called for a moratorium. And I think Malaysia is following that. According to Amnesty International, 87 countries and territories have abolished the death penalty. 11 countries have abolished it for all but exceptional crimes, such as wartime betrayal. 27 countries retain the death penalty, but have not carried out any execution for the past 10 years. So all in all, in comparison with 71 countries having death penalty, there are nearly 125 or so countries that have moved away from the death penalty in law and practice. A second argument against the death penalty is, even for war crimes, under the International Criminal Court, there is no death penalty for war crimes. It is life imprisonment. Then drug offenses. Most nations don't regard drug offenses as sufficiently serious to warrant a death penalty. Also, a very powerful argument against death penalty for drugs is this, that in most drug cases, the person who is accused and convicted is not the real person. He's not the mastermind. He's just a mule, a young person tempted by the lure of a little bit of money, or in some cases deceived into it. So the death penalty for drugs, basically we are catching the wrong people. The main players are neither apprehended nor deterred. A further argument against death penalty, especially under the DDA, Dangerous Drugs Act, is there are a bundle of unfair presumptions. So a person in possession is presumed to have knowledge. A person with possession and knowledge is presumed to be a drug trafficker if there was more than a certain quantity of drugs. The quantity varies from drug to drug. In Alma Nudo Atenza, this issue was raised, where the double presumption is allowed. Alma Nudo Atenza 2019, I think, said double presumption is unconstitutional. However, it did not say that all presumptions are unconstitutional. So there can be presumption. I think unfair presumption of possession or of trafficking are not right. And I'll be asking for their abolition. Then I notice that yours is a constitutional law committee. Let me raise some constitutional arguments. I'm tempted as a student of constitutional law. The mandatory nature of the death penalty, in my view, violates Article 121, the judicial power of the Federation. If a judge has the right to adjudicate a case, to listen to the evidence, to weigh the defense and the prosecution evidence, and to find the person guilty or innocent, then the judge should also have the right to impose the penalty. The judge's task is not simply to decide guilt or innocence. Judge's task also is to suit the penal, to choose the penalty to suit the offense. But mandatory death penalty in so many laws basically violate the judge's discretion to choose the right penalty under the law. Further, mandatory death penalty violates Article 8, equality before the law and equal protection of the law. Equality before the law basically requires that like should be treated alike, and unlike should be treated differently. Like should be treated alike, and unlike should be treated dissimilarly. Now, there are murders and there are murders, in the sense that the facts may be different. May I give you a simple example? If a woman has been raped, God forbid, she files a report, she inquires, she keeps on inquiring, but the police are either unable to catch or not willing to catch. Or let us say at the trial, some technicality, the person is acquitted, he walks free. But the pain in the victim's heart has not gone away. In the case of rape, it's not like physical pain, it will go away. The pain is still there. So now what she does is she gets a gun or a knife and she goes and kills him. Is that murder or not? Under the law, it will probably amount to murder because it was not self-defense. It was not during the commission of the rape. She waited, she waited, she waited, she planned. She got the knife or the gun. She went to the place. She shot him dead in cold blood. It's murder. Now, there's something wrong with the legal system that would impose the death penalty on this woman. I think surely the judge should have discretion to say, you have no right to take the law in your hand. You are therefore guilty of culpable homicide, not amounting to murder or causing death, etc., but not murder. So I think this mandatory nature violates Article 8 because it forces the judges to treat every murder accused as alike, even though in some cases they are not alike. I can tell you this, David. I have talked to judges who have presided over death penalty offenses, and some judges have told me the evidence was quite clear. The accused had even confessed. But the judge, deep down in his heart, in his instincts, was of the opinion that the accused was actually hiding things. She was protecting someone. Mother was protecting a son. Brother was protecting a brother, something like that. So the judge's hands are tied. I don't think that should be so. Also, another constitutional argument, mandatory nature may be violating Article 5, Clause 1. Article 5, Clause 1 says, no person shall be deprived of his life or personal liberty, save in accordance with law. The word law does not mean any law whatsoever passed by Parliament. The word law means a proportionate law. A law that is reasonable, a law that is not oppressive. At least that's my view. And I think that's the view of Alma Nudo Atenza. However, I have to confess to you with sadness that the judges are deeply, deeply divided on this issue. Many judges have said that whether the law is harsh or oppressive is not for judges to decide. It's for Parliament to decide. Che Ani Itam, 1984, Lao Ki He, 1984, they say separation of powers. We only enforce the law. It's not our job to make the law. It's not our job to look at the harshness or oppressiveness of the law. But to all these judges, I would say, please read Alma Nudo Atenza 2019, which says the word law does not mean any law whatsoever. Three more arguments against the death penalty. There is fallibility and there is finality. Fallibility means you are the Pandava Raya. It's entirely possible you and the judge may make a mistake, may interpret facts wrongly, fallibility, mistakes, and finality. Once you hang someone, that's it. You can't bring life back. You know, in the USA, since 1973, 123 prisoners have been released after evidence emerged of their innocence for crimes for which they were sentenced to death. They were sentenced to death later on because of the persistence of their loved ones or a persistence of their lawyers. It was found that actually there was some miscarriage of justice. Then, of course, we have noted there is no deterrence. And finally, a very important social point, David. Data has indicated that around the world, the death penalty is administered primarily to the poor, to the minorities, to the marginalized. It is the fundamental right of the poor. So it is disproportionately administered. The minorities, the marginalized, the poor, they are victimized. This is an issue of unequal administration. It's an issue of justice, which I think we should all take note of. So I think I will conclude on this by saying, David, I personally do not favor the death penalty, but I fully acknowledge that there are pros and cons on both sides. The passions run deep, and we have to make our own judgment on this issue.
All right, thank you so much. And I think, Prof. Shad, you've already answered the next two questions that I've prepared just now in your previous answer. So I think due to time constraints, shall we proceed to the last question?
Okay, sure.
All right. So, Prof. Shad, to conclude on this issue today, do you think as citizens living in Malaysia, in this country, that's practicing this sentencing, as you mentioned earlier, mandatory death penalty and death penalty, do we need to reform the law on these two sentencing?
Of course, David. The law can never stand still. The law must always respond to the felt necessities of the times. The morality in 1957 or in 1963 or in 1971 after the emergency, that was a different morality. I think we need to keep pace with the times. Without doubt, we need to reform the law. However, there are two ways of reforming. One would be an evolutionary approach. In other words, you go step by step. You try to take as many people, as many groups as possible with you. You walk the path of moderation, compromise, the middle path. The other one is a clean cut with the past. You make the change. Doesn't matter whether people like it or not. So I would personally recommend an evolutionary approach, given the fact that society is deeply, deeply divided. I would like to say that the total abolition of death penalty can wait. We can proceed in an evolutionary way. But I have five suggestions. Number one, do away with all mandatory penalties. In other words, it should never be mandatory. The judge must have the discretion to tailor the punishment to suit the offense. I think we can trust the judges. In the case of mandatory penalties, the public prosecutor decides whether to charge under culpable homicide 303 or charge under 300 murder. So I would like to ask the question, if you can trust the public prosecutor, why can't you trust the judge? In fact, the judge is, by his nature, by his temperament, by his appointment, by the nature of his job, he's in a better position to make an objective judgment. So all mandatory penalties should be abolished and the discretion of the judge should be restored. Number two, do away with presumptions. In all crimes, when presumptions are made of guilt, I think we should do away with those. Everyone should be innocent till proven guilty. We must remove these presumptions, especially in death penalty laws. All presumptions in death penalty laws must be taken away. I think the prosecutor must prove the case. Number three, we must narrow down the offenses, David. At the moment, you mentioned 33, some say 14, but I think it depends on how one counts. I personally think we need to reduce the range of offenses for which the death penalty is imposed. For example, I'm personally opposed to death penalty for political offenses. Because in political offenses, David, you are in power and I'm out of power, you have the power to penalize me. But if you were out of power and I were in power, your actions would be treasonable and mine would be patriotic and vice versa. Don't forget, at one time, Nelson Mandela was accused and convicted of treason in South Africa. But fortunately, they didn't hang him. He went on to become the president of independent South Africa. And I would say he was one of the greatest figures of the last century. So, political offenses, Section 121, Section 121A, Section 132. In my view, these offenses have a strong political nature in them. I think they should not be punished with death. Then Section 306, abetment of suicide. I think this is controversial. In many countries, euthanasia is being allowed. People are allowed to bring an end to their life. Now, I'm not saying we should go that way, but the point is this. There are some people who do not wish to suffer any longer. Sometimes their life is full of suffering. They go to a doctor and say, give me this medicine or give me this injection. Or they ask a loved one to help them. And then the loved one or the doctor will then be accused of abetment of suicide. So I think Section 306, we need to look at it. Then drug trafficking, 39B. I think we need to abolish the death penalty for drugs. I want to say this right away. I abhor the idea of drug taking or drug trafficking. These are heinous crimes. It's a form of subversion, actually. Nevertheless, given the fact that there have been lot of very controversial cases, people have grown plants in their house for medicinal purposes and they've been accused of drug trafficking. There are some plants which are medicinal. Historically, traditionally, we have used them for medicine. And now they are actually in the schedule and they are actually regarded as drugs for which they would be mandatory death. So I think 39B should go. Then even if the death penalty is retained, there should be review of each death sentence. I recommend that each death sentence should be mandatorily reviewed by the Pardons Board. Whether the convict applies or not, the Pardons Board must review it. Due process should be allowed to enable the convict and any interested person to plead in mitigation. Not just the convict, others on his behalf to plead in mitigation, which means the rules of locus standi in death penalty cases must be as liberal as possible. With these reforms, a better balance can be achieved. In the long term, I think, David, there should be total abolition. As I mentioned earlier, morally, I look at it this way. If an individual killing another individual is wrong, then the state killing individuals will also have to be wrong. So in the long term, there should be total abolition. But at the moment, in an evolutionary way, we could make some of the changes that I humbly recommend. But I fully acknowledge to you that there are conflicting perspectives and there are no simple solutions. We have to try nevertheless to find solutions suitable for our times and for our society. But one of your questions sent to me was, and I will end on that, what about public perceptions? Public perceptions, David, are important politically, no doubt. Politically, they're important. But we are dealing with a moral issue. We're dealing with a human rights issue. And in these issues, David, leaders of substance should not follow opinion polls. They should mold opinion, not with guns or dollars or position, but with the power of their souls. That's what Jesse Jackson, the civil rights leader of the USA, said. And may I end by saying this to you. If you are a conductor of an orchestra and you want to conduct the music, David, you have to turn your back to the audience. You have to turn your back to the audience. In politics also, if you want to conduct the music of justice, of fair play, then you have to turn your back to the audience sometimes. Okay, that's all that I wanted to say.
Wow. Wow, Prof. Shad. Yeah, with that, we've reached the end of our episode. Thank you, Prof. Shad. Thank you so, so much for your time to be with us today. And I believe everyone that listened to your insights and your sharing really, really appreciates what you've done. And wow, just again, thank you so much. We hope you have a great time with us on the show. To catch UM Consti Team's latest activities, do follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at UM Consti Team. Thank you, and do stick around for the next episode.